Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm looking at another PragerU video, this one titled, The Best Book to Read to Your Kids. It's being presented by a guy named Johnny Moore, who is the president of the Congress of Christian Leaders. So, spoiler alert, the book he says is the best book to read to your kids is the Bible. Which, I assume at some point he's going to mention to skip over all the blood, gore, you know what? YouTube doesn't like it when I talk about such wholesome biblical content too close to the beginning of the video, so... yeah, we'll get into that later. You can guess what I was about to say. If not, I'll give you a hint. Look up who Cain's wife had to be. Let's go!
There's a book you can read to your children that will make your job as a parent a lot easier.
Because if you read them a book that explains that they should be beaten with a weapon if they misbehave, and that they will be tortured for all eternity if they don't believe that book, then that'll totally make parenting way easier. Even if it actually did make parenting easier, I don't think that traumatizing my kids into behaving is really a great way to go about achieving that outcome.
This book will teach them lessons in character, how to distinguish right from wrong, about gratitude, respect, and perseverance. And that's in the opening chapters.
What I learned from the opening chapters is that God doesn't pay close attention to what his own creations are up to. He's willing to create trees that have the potential to completely ruin everything that he made and then place those trees in easily accessible locations. He made people without the ability to tell right from wrong and then got mad at them when they did something that was supposed to have been wrong. He shows favoritism among people who are just doing their best to please him. Marrying your siblings is okay, and I could go on and on and on. And that's just the first four chapters. Get up to six chapters, and we get a God who wants to kill everything because some of the things aren't behaving quite the way he wants them to.
Parents have been reading this book to their children for a very long time,
indicating that it likely contains some outdated advice, like the aforementioned beating children with a weapon, namely a rod. Modern Christians usually play this down and advocate for spanking, though I have heard a shocking number of stories from people who were regularly hit with wooden spoons as punishment, an event which traumatized them enough that they refused to even own wooden spoons as an adult, and certain sounds can still trigger the fear of an imminent beating, but even downplayed to just spanking with your hand, the evidence is clear and universal. Spanking is not effective at correcting behavior and is not good for the child's mental health, either in the short term or the long term. And yet, the Bible has not received an update to remove all the verses about how hitting your kids is the best way to save their soul. Being old and traditional does not automatically make something good.
It's one reason it's a perpetual bestseller. This book, of course, is the Bible.
What? I'm so shocked that the president of the Congress of Christian Leaders is advocating for the Bible. I never saw that coming.
And you don't have to be religious to read it, and your children don't have to be religious to enjoy it and get a whole lot out of it.
Well then, oh boy, do I have a podcast for you. You see, while I definitely wouldn't recommend this for everyone, I am currently reading the Bible to my daughter, and I'm doing that as part of a podcast so that everybody can hear her unfiltered reaction to these Bible stories. We're almost through Genesis, and so far her main takeaways are that God is a jerk, the patriarchs of the religion are bad parents, and there are no good guys because everyone from God to the lowly servants behaves atrociously.
Decency, kindness, charity, selflessness, and sacrifice.
All characteristics that are notoriously absent from the Bible thus far in my podcast. We're on chapter 42 of Genesis at this point.
They're all right there.
Where? Okay, I know there are some in the Bible, but dude, you can't seriously be advocating for actually reading the whole Bible if that's what you want people to get out of it. Are you sure you're not recommending some daily devotional plan? I mean, let's be real, even if he doesn't specify that, most Christian parents are going to Google up a list of good stories for kids in the Bible, or they'll read sanitized children's storybooks that sometimes cite Bible verses and call that reading the Bible. But like, if you read the actual stories, it is really hard to come away from them thinking that they taught valuable moral lessons. Unless the lesson you want them to get is to just be scared of God, because he will fuck your shit up if you don't behave exactly as he wants you to behave.
Consider the story of David and Goliath.
That wholesome, good, moral story of the time when God wanted a replacement for King Saul because King Saul just wasn't genocidal enough for God. So God sent David to kill Goliath, and when David was working in King Saul's service, God tormented Saul by making him go mad until eventually David would replace him. Also, fun fact, this is a story where a pretty blatant biblical contradiction can be found. In 1 Samuel 17:50, David kills Goliath with a sling and a stone. But in the next verse, David kills Goliath again, but this time with Goliath's own sword. And of course, this is all before Goliath gets killed again by Elhanan later on in 2 Samuel 21:19. Goliath somehow managed to die three times in the Bible without being resurrected once. That's quite the accomplishment.
9 feet tall, clad in armor, Goliath is the most fearsome warrior of his day. How could he not be? He's 9 feet tall, for goodness sake.
I'm not exactly much of a fighter myself, but I feel like there's a bit more to being a good fighter than just being tall.
Who wants to go against a giant like that?
And that's really the question, isn't it? Because Goliath challenged the Israelite army for 40 days, apparently. Now, worth mentioning here is that oftentimes in the Bible, the phrase 40 days isn't meant to be a literal 40 days, but is meant to denote just a general long period of time, often associated with trials or difficult times. But no matter how you slice it, for a long period of time, several days at least, and 40 days according to the literalists, the two armies would get up and line up facing each other just for Goliath to go out and challenge them to send over one soldier to defeat him. This challenge was terrifying enough that the whole Israelite army would be scared and run away. Seems weird that the Philistines wouldn't just attack at that point, but okay. My point here is that there was a long period of time between when Goliath started issuing challenges and when David showed up to face the challenge, and during this time, King Saul was offering a significant reward for whoever could beat Goliath. Great wealth, marriage to his daughter, and no more taxes for that person's family. And in a long period of time, nobody even attempted to earn that reward? That's just not believable. But yeah, a completely untrained shepherd boy is the only person with the guts to even try. You know, on account of Goliath being tall. All army guys are afraid of people that are taller than them, right?
No Israelite, that's for sure. Except for one. A skinny shepherd boy named David. This boy has three things going for him. Courage, a slingshot, and faith that God is with him.
He also had a bunch of armor given to him by the king that he ended up taking off because he wasn't used to it. Moral of the story there is to have faith in God to protect you instead of in real, tangible things that actually protect you. Considering the fact that God doesn't appear to exist and at the very least behaves as though he doesn't exist, this does not make for very good advice.
As he strides out onto the battlefield to face Goliath in single combat, he holds the future of the Israelite nation. Not to mention his own life, in his hands.
Yeah, there's another problem with the story. King Saul could have, and probably would have, said, "No, I don't think that I will trust a shepherd boy with the future of the nation," and turned David down. And yeah, there's that whole line where David convinces him by explaining that he's killed lions and bears. But the king has an army full of men, some of whom have probably also killed lions and bears, but are also trained in combat, so they could actually win a single combat challenge with a tall guy. And this is how we know that nobody else accepted the challenge. It's not that a bunch of people fought him and then lost, and David was their last hope. It was that nobody dared to fight him, and should anyone lose that fight, that would constitute a loss for the army that would have had the Israelites becoming the slaves of the Philistines. Since that didn't happen, we can assume that that didn't happen, I guess.
Wrapped up in all of this tension and drama are valuable lessons that any child can profit from.
Any good lessons you can get from this story can be had from secular children's books in a much less gruesome way, and without having to overlook and ignore significant parts of the story in order to make it make sense, and with the added bonus of actually being interesting to read as well. Caramba, for instance, tells the story of a cat named Caramba who feels left out because he's the only cat who can't fly. He learns to confront his fears and eventually figures out that, yeah, he really can't fly, but he can swim. Of course, the other cats make fun of him for swimming like a fish instead of flying like a cat, but he learns to be proud of his unique ability.
David refuses to be intimidated by a bully.
So does Caramba. When made fun of for being a swimming cat, Caramba refuses to be intimidated and continues to enjoy swimming anyway.
He's willing to act, to show resolve, even in the face of his own self-doubt.
Eventually, Caramba learns that as well, and has the bonus of actually being an interesting story to read while making more sense than the Bible story. That's right, a story about flying and swimming cats makes more sense and requires less suspension of disbelief than the David and Goliath story.
His actions paint a portrait of true heroism in the face of true danger.
Okay, Caramba doesn't really hit on that one all that hard. But how about the paper bag princess for that one? After her whole castle, including all her clothes, gets burned down by a dragon who steals the prince that she is engaged to marry, she dons a paper bag and goes to challenge the dragon. Eventually, she tricks the dragon into overexerting itself and tries to rescue Prince Ronald while the dragon is asleep. But Ronald ends up being a jerk who cares more about appearances than character, and so she rejects Ronald and lives happily ever after without him. She was in true danger. She put her life on the line to rescue her fiancé, and then she didn't fall into the sunk cost fallacy when he turned out to be a chauvinistic asshole.
Isn't that the kind of strength we want our children to emulate?
I mean, I think I'll take the one where nobody gets their head chopped off because they're the wrong religion and they're gross for not having bits of their penises removed. The one that doesn't have those details seems superior and much less likely to lead to things like bigotry.
To be able to defend themselves, and later, their families and their country.
I would be perfectly happy if none of my kids ever joined the military. Call me a dreamer, but I think the world would be a much better place if war wasn't a thing. Yes, I know there are sometimes geopolitical considerations that can make war a necessary evil, but all else being equal, I'd rather have it so that joining the military in order to defend a country is not a necessity for my kids. And on top of that, there are different kinds of courage. The draft-dodging hippies of the 60s and 70s were showing courage when they risked being imprisoned for the sake of upholding their principles. Agree or disagree with the wars they were protesting, it takes courage to stand firm on your convictions in the face of sometimes brutal opposition.
Or how about the story of the brothers, Cain and Abel?
Oh, I can't wait to see what moral you're going to get out of that story.
Abel, the shepherd, looks at his lot, and he's filled with gratitude for his blessings. He offers as a gift to God the very best of his flock.
Close. It doesn't actually say that he offered the very best. It says that he offered the firstborn. Now, sometimes these two concepts are kind of entwined in the Bible, but not always. And actually, as a lot of preachers are fond of sermonizing about, one of the themes of the Bible is the lifting up of the underdog, the younger children being exalted above their firstborn siblings. David is one such example. He had three older brothers. Joseph was the second youngest of the 12 brothers, Jacob was the younger brother, and so on. Now, this might seem like a pedantic thing to bring up, but I feel like he's going to imply that Abel was more willing to sacrifice the better things to God than Cain, and that's why God favored his offering. But this detail doesn't actually show up in the story. At least, not explicitly. At best, it's implied. Though, to be fair, in order to understand that it even is implied, I had to bust out my Anchor Bible translation, where they explain in great detail why they chose to use the words that they chose. Because most English versions don't even imply it. And I feel like most parents wouldn't choose the Anchor Bible as their preferred translation to read to the kids.
Cain, the farmer, is selfish, unsatisfied with what he has, and he offers only a paltry gift of grain.
Yeah, there it is. See? That's not what the story says. Now, first, I couldn't even find a translation that called it grain and not fruit, but that's kind of a minor point that doesn't matter. Secondly, there is no hint in the story, at least not when rendered in English, that his offering was of a stingy variety. He grows plants. He doesn't have livestock, so he offers plants as his sacrifice, because that's what he has to offer. But God likes the smell of burning flesh better than fruit, so God favors Abel's offering. Well, not quite. It doesn't actually say that in the story either. That's me editorializing a bit. The Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, and did not have regard for Cain and his offering. But at the end of the day, it does not actually say that Cain did anything wrong with his offering, just that God didn't have regard for it.
When God favors Abel's present, Cain allows jealousy to overwhelm him. God speaks to Cain and tells him, "I know you're feeling angry, but you can overcome those feelings and master them." Cain doesn't listen, doesn't control his jealousy, and kills Abel.
Good, wholesome family story to read to the kids, am I right?
When God asks Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" Cain lies and says, "I do not know." And then, "Am I my brother's keeper?" Yes, should have been Cain's answer to his own question. We are responsible for ourselves, and we have an obligation to others.
And there are many, many kids' books out there that can teach that lesson without also pointing out that Cain basically gets away with literally murdering his brother. Yeah, he gets caught, but his punishment is just to be a fugitive, who nobody is allowed to kill, who is forced to wander the earth, until a couple sentences later where he just settles in the land of Nod and becomes the founder of a city. There is no apparent punishment for this murder. And on top of that, God offers to protect Cain with a special marking and stating that anyone who kills Cain shall get sevenfold back on him in vengeance. Which I guess would mean killing that person and six members of their family or people that are close to them, since he can only kill a guy once. Well, maybe not. Goliath died three times after all. But yeah, that punishment seems fair. And yeah, I totally want to suggest to my kids that the punishment for literally murdering their siblings will be for them to be protected from any sort of real consequence of that, as well as the promise that I'll protect them to a much greater extent than I protected their sibling from them. It's hard enough to get them to not hit or push each other as it is without telling them that murder is an option.
We all have emotions and passions, but God has given us the tools to master those emotions. And master them we must if we are to live a productive and ethical life.
I mean, again, kids' books, young adult books, and basically every good story out there has a point at which the protagonist makes some bad decisions, often based on an emotional overreaction to something. And the consequences of these decisions serve to drive the narrative from that point on. Cain's bad emotional decision is just the end of the story in this one, though. He then goes on to have kids, found a city, and lives happily ever after with no real resolution to the plot of the story. So not only can you get the same message from stories that aren't the Bible, but you can get them in a much more entertaining form and in a way that shows negative consequences for these bad actions, with the protagonist actually having to learn from their mistake.
Most important of all, life is a gift from God. We have no right to take it away from the innocent.
I like how PragerU, being a decidedly pro-death penalty organization, just has to throw in the bit about taking life from the innocent there.
Murder is evil.
And from this story, we learn that murdering the murderer is more evil than the first murder. You know, since the punishment for anyone who killed Cain would be sevenfold. If the Old Testament weren't so obviously pro-death penalty elsewhere, this story could easily be used to argue that God sees retributive justice as a greater evil than the crime that is being punished in the first place.
All these lessons are contained in this one story.
Not very well, though.
The stories of David and Goliath and Cain and Abel are only two examples of the many invaluable lessons the Bible offers to children.
And they're not great ones. You'd think that you'd have picked the best examples in your sales pitch trying to convince people that this is a good book to read to kids, but no, you go with killing your siblings is only moderately bad, and if you don't commit genocide when God wants you to, then he'll replace you with the younger, sexier model. I mean, sure, you can kind of get all the stuff out of these stories that you're saying you can get out of them, but you have to ignore a lot of really, really bad stuff in order to get there. The problem with wading through shit to find nuggets of corn is that when you're done, even if you manage to scrounge together a whole cob, you're still covered in shit.
Think of a lesson, and there's a Bible story to teach it.
Trans rights are human rights. Find me that Bible story. Women should be equal to men. Owning human beings as property is bad. Gay marriage is good. Consent is an important part of sex. The list goes on.
About family dynamics, friendship, forgiveness, leadership, humility, about what is important and what is not.
And what if we disagree with a lot of those lessons? Like family dynamics. Why should the man be the head of the household? Why is it disgraceful for a wife to cut her hair short? And with that long hair, why is she not allowed to braid it? Why should women not be allowed to teach or to exercise authority over a man, instead remaining quiet? This doesn't sound like a healthy family dynamic. It sounds like an overbearing and controlling family dynamic. And that's just against women. For the family as a whole, we get, "I have not come to bring peace, but a sword, for I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a person's enemies will be those of his own household." Yeah, that sounds like a great family dynamic. For friendship, yeah, sure, there are some stories like David and Jonathan, where Jonathan shows his friendship by giving David a striptease, which, to be clear, this story would be a whole lot more wholesome if they just came out and said that they were lovers, but in 2 Thessalonians 3, it tells you to basically shun anyone who doesn't obey what is laid out in that letter. 2 John 1 tells you to not allow anyone into your house or to even greet anyone who doesn't bring the teaching of Christ. Shunning people who disagree with you is not a great form of friendship. And I could go on with the rest of the things that you listed. For every verse or story that you can find that shows some positive quality for any of the things that you've said, I could find a verse or story that is atrocious on that very same matter.
The Bible also teaches children, more effectively than any book ever, that they are not the center of the universe.
I mean, that's debatable, but sure. A book that advocates child abuse and even has the death penalty for a child who is sufficiently disobedient could certainly be used to teach a child that they are unimportant. But again, on the flip side, you often hear children's versions of these Bible stories emphasizing that God loves them so much that he did X, Y, or Z for them. So the all-powerful creator of the universe cares deeply about you personally. But at the same time, you really suck and aren't worth such attention, so you'd better appreciate it and feel bad anytime you do or think anything that isn't approved of.
They're accountable to their parents and to God.
I have a question at this point. At the beginning of the video, you said,
"And you don't have to be religious to read it, and your children don't have to be religious to enjoy it."
So, as a non-religious parent of non-religious children, why would you think that I would want my kids to feel like they're accountable to God? Especially when God's moral system is so very, well, immoral.
Children who internalize this lesson are much more likely to be kinder and more mindful of how they behave than those who do not.
Citation needed. Now, being PragerU, if you're willing to dig a bit, they do list sources for what they say, and usually the sources end up being things like articles written on the PragerU blog or other PragerU videos, but occasionally you actually find something legitimate. But for this claim, that kids who internalize the message that they are accountable to God will be kinder and more mindful of how they behave, just flies by with no reference whatsoever, not even a mention of such a claim on the list of references. Now, I did look into it. There is a certain correlation between kids raised with religion and behavior, but the effect of religion is questionable, as the relationship goes away when you control for things like parent-child relationships. In other words, having a good relationship with your kids is likely much more important when it comes to getting your kids to behave properly than religion is. And of course, there was that whole thing where weekly church attendance showed a correlation with better behavior, but the improvement here was tied to regular community gatherings rather than the actual religion.
The Bible discourages narcissism.
I mean, narcissism is a personality disorder, and not only am I not qualified to diagnose it, but even for qualified people, it's always a bad idea to attempt to diagnose people that you have never met in person. But if we're just talking about people having an inflated sense of their own self-importance and thereby colloquially using a medical term in a way that leads to stigma against people who legitimately need help, then yeah, I'd say that the belief that the creator of the universe thought you were important enough that he would directly intervene in your life and make plans that revolve specifically around you fits the bill. I mean, hell, here you are suggesting that even non-religious people should read your holy book because your holy book is obviously the most important place to get these lessons from, even though there are other holy books with the same lessons, not to mention actual entertaining books that teach these lessons in a much more relatable way. But no, forget all of that. People should read the book that you like, and it's just assumed that if they did, they would be better people for it. No need to include a source backing that up. How could it be wrong? And while you're sitting here feeling all self-important about your book, you point out that the book teaches you not to be self-important, and you somehow completely miss the irony here.
Of course, the Bible is not merely a children's book.
I'd go so far as to say that it's not even a children's book.
It's a library of wisdom for everyone.
Only if you have a really weird definition of wisdom.
Here's how Abraham Lincoln, who was not a churchgoer, but who was steeped in the Bible, described it. In regard to this great book, it is the best gift God has given to man. But for it, we could not know right from wrong. And all things most desirable for man's welfare are to be found portrayed in it.
Okay, what's your point? I disagree with Abe Lincoln on that point. Do you think that because he is generally regarded as having been a pretty good president of the United States, that now everybody has to take everything he says as being true?
As Lincoln suggests, the Bible is the moral foundation on which Western civilization is built and a point of shared reference.
Yeah, I'm not going to get into that now, but if you are interested in why that's not actually true, I mean, not whether or not Lincoln believed it was true, but whether the idea that Western civilization, particularly American culture, was built on the Bible, then I'd recommend the book The Founding Myth by Andrew Seidel. And actually, as long as we're on the topic, this kind of betrays just how American-centric this guy's thinking is. Western civilization is a term that typically looks to ancient Greece as having been the foundational culture. And ancient Greece, not sure if you knew this, but it was decidedly not Christian. So when he says Western civilization, what he means is American civilization. And even on that point, he's wrong.
Up until the 1960s, you could cite a Bible story, and most people knew exactly what you were talking about. Everyone from Shakespeare to Dickens to Franklin Roosevelt made great use of Bible stories to communicate their themes.
So what? Nowadays, you can reference Star Wars, and everyone will know what you're talking about. Does the fact that everyone is familiar with it somehow lend credence to the argument that everyone should read from the Star Wars novelization to their kids in order to teach them life lessons? Though, really, I feel like they'd do better with those than they would with the Bible, so maybe you're onto something. There's less incest, at least. I mean, it's not all gone, but there's less of it.
We're losing that connection, and that is a terrible shame.
I am not going to deny that the Bible is certainly a book of historical and cultural significance, but that does not mean that everybody should read it regularly. The Epic of Gilgamesh was a story of historical and cultural significance as well, and it would most definitely be a real shame if we were to somehow completely lose it. This does not mean that I think that reading to your kids out of the Epic of Gilgamesh is something that all parents should do.
And a profound cultural loss.
Culture left the Bible behind a long time ago, and the church has been struggling to reinterpret the Bible in order to keep up with culture ever since. If you want to go back to true biblical culture, you'd have to go back a lot further than the 1960s. I'd actually argue that original Christian culture didn't last more than a generation, because even in the very texts of the Bible itself, we see Paul speaking out against Peter's teachings, put right next to books that speak out against Paul's teachings in favor of Peter's teachings. We lost true Christian culture as soon as the guys who founded Christianity died, and people like Paul would be appalled at how permissive the most restrictive branch of modern Christianity is. So, yeah, original biblical culture wasn't really a thing, and original Christian culture disappeared with its founders, and even its founders would disagree on what it was at the time.
If you don't have some biblical literacy, you can't fully appreciate the powerful words of Martin Luther King, for example. Only if you know the story of Moses can you fully appreciate King's poetic vision of having seen the Promised Land.
I actually think that only having a passing understanding of the story gives you a better appreciation for the analogy. You know, since the whole Promised Land thing was when God promised that he would give land that already belonged to other people to the Hebrews, resulting in the subsequent command to commit genocide on the people that were there when the Hebrews finally arrived, Now, obviously that's not the message that Dr. King was trying to get across. He clearly just wanted to paint a picture of a utopian vision that he had for the future, and he used biblical language to accomplish this. A superficial understanding is all that is necessary here, and it actually works better if you only have a superficial understanding.
Of the Bible, Yale theologian George Lindbeck famously said, "There was a time when every educated person, no matter how professedly unbelieving or secular, knew the actual text from Genesis to Revelation."
Yeah, there was a time when everyone was forced to at least pay lip service to the idea of Christianity being true, or else they would be shunned from most of society. This is not a good thing.
Our goal should be to get back to that kind of biblical literacy.
Why? I mean, I certainly think that at least Christians should get there, and then maybe we'd have fewer Christians than there are now, you know, since the book is so horrible, both in writing style and in its messages. But I see no reason why non-religious people should want to be more familiar with the Bible, unless it's something that they are just legitimately interested in.
And it starts with our children. Your children.
Translation? Get them while they're young.
Read them a Bible story tonight.
Yeah, I read Bible stories to my daughter regularly. It doesn't have the effect that I think you're hoping for. So, I guess I'm coming out of this agreeing with him. Read the Bible to your kids, but don't read sanitized kids' versions. Read the actual book, unfiltered.
Who knows? You might learn a few things too.
I have. I've learned a lot. This is actually my first time reading the Bible straight through since leaving Christianity, and boy oh boy are there things that I just completely missed when I was a Christian. So we got through this whole video and he didn't give a single compelling reason to choose the Bible as a book to read to my kids over any other book. And that's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Serpentinius, who says, "When you mentioned the curse of Ham, my very first thought was of Ken Ham. I still think it fits." Yeah, you know, let's actually do that. Let's change the meaning there. From now on, the curse of Ham is not that super racist belief that Noah's son Ham was cursed for looking at his dad's dick by giving him and his descendants dark skin and thus justifying race-based slavery because the Bible says that all of Ham's descendants will be slaves. It's now the curse that Australia put on the United States by sending them Ken Ham. Thanks for watching, and holy shit, guys, thank you so much for being the generous group that you are. We've still got 24 days left in my fundraiser, as of this recording. It'll be more like 18 days when the video goes up, and we're less than $800 away from the goal. For those of you listening on the podcast, in the video version, I put a clip of me changing the goal from $7,000 to $14,000. It was funny, I promise. And if you really need to see it, I'll probably remember to include a link to that clip by itself in the show notes, if I don't, feel free to yell at me in comment form. I see them if you go to the podcast page on Spreaker, which can be found at podcast.vicerino.com. I mean, we're nearly halfway to our goal. Great work and keep it up. You can go to vicerino.com/donate to donate. Thanks for watching. Special thanks as always to my patrons, Mark McManus, Mark Hetchum, Clench Eastwood, Lynn Dobbs, and all the rest, who are the good children's stories that can be found in the book that is my channel. If you'd like to be way more interesting and engaging than the Bible, almost by default, you can join us on Patreon for as little as $1 per week over at patreon.com/vicerino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist. Links to social media, all the ways to support the channel, and to other projects like my podcast with my daughter can be found at links.vicerino.com. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my PO Box address is in the description. See you next time!